Hello, everyone. I'm Erin Schaefer. I'm the Grad Assistant at the Women's Center. I'd like to welcome you to another session of Spring 2012 Women on Wednesday series, Exploring and Making Visible Women's Intersecting Identities. This semester series on women's intersecting identities is exploring the rich layers of women's multiple identities and how these intersections shape their lived experiences and perceptions. A few items before we get started. You can please turn off your cell phones and also please remain seated until 12:50 as a courtesy to our speaker. If you could please fill out the evaluation forms, we use your feedback for future programming. Also, if I could draw your attention to the bookmark that you received when you came in. In honor of National Women's History Month, the Women's Center, along with Women's Action, will be screening the film Misrepresentation this evening from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. in the Miller Center, room 122. The film challenges the media's limited and often disparaging portrayals of women and girls, which makes it difficult for women to achieve leadership positions and for the average woman to feel powerful herself. Our session today is titled One Transgendered Woman's Story. Our speaker today is Gina Marie Bernard. Ms. Bernard will discuss her experience transitioning from male to female as an advocate for marginalized individuals. Gina Marie Bernard is an English teacher at Bemidji High School, where she teaches AP Literature and College American Literature courses. She's a published novelist, poet, and short fiction writer, and has trained for and completed 6 marathons. We are very grateful to have her here with us today. Please join the Women's Center in welcoming Gina Marie Bernard.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Gina Marie Bernard, and I would like to thank Erin and the staff at the Women's Center for having me present today. Always kind of odd when you're asked to talk about yourself, but since that's what you asked me to do, that will be what I will be doing today. I am here with a very dear friend, Nina Labarsky. Nina, say hi to everybody. Nina teaches art and is in a band with me. We're in the Loud Sweater Band together. So she took the day off of work to come down and be with me, so I appreciate you offering your support as well. So, you want to know about my duality, my identity, my transsexuality. It's true, I may seem a bit of a rarity. Spent many years in therapy, all because I hated my plurality, questioned my sanity. Each breath I took reminded me of the supreme irony of my entirety. Some claim my immortality is in jeopardy, that I make a mockery out of morality, that I will spend an eternity burning for the enormity of my nonconformity. But am I a monstrosity? Is the woman you see inherently some biological anomaly? How horribly we react to dissimilarity. So please, temporarily, set aside any need to categorically assign me to familiarity. I'm here primarily, and with all sincerity, to assert without temerity that we, you and me, all fall on a continuum of diversity. Don't agree? Well, allow me an analogy. Like any book, I have a cover, but open me up and you'll discover that my narrative is not some other, rather it is just another. And I hope my critique, these words that I speak, will tweak your curiosity. Pique your curiosity, tweak you consciously to the distinct possibility that our stories, though unique, also speak to the similarity of the human condition, to a shared homogeny. And it is my position, my mission, to get you to listen. We're all the same. And my aim shall remain to claim that it is insane, this need to proclaim that it's us versus them. How banal, how inane. Why must you stare, or worse, glare with hate in your eyes, or dare to pass judgment, to mock and to jeer, or to blare ignorant obscenities like faggot or queer? So you sneer at the way I appear? Who the fuck cares? I don't recall asking you ever to share. Who are you to declare that I'm a freak or a queen? And spare me your sanctimonious prayers. I'm aware that I inspire in you an unfathomable fear, that you find me bizarre and dangerously impure, but you can keep your appeals the true way that you feel to yourself if you please. Grow up. I'm not going anywhere. I'm the girl next door, and none of your slurs will adhere to me or force me to be what you find acceptable. See, I'm not your enemy, and I will not bow to your enmity. I refuse to be defined by your childish insecurity or your profound inadequacy, the prejudice belying your love, the sinner, insincerity. What a bunch of hypocritical piety. Yes, it's a dangerous world for tees like me, who tease apart the threads of an artificial gender binary, who refuse to be abused or to appease others' unease. So I'm a threat, a disease. And for many years, I accepted these labels, expected the tables never to turn, and inside it burned, that I was unable to remain stable or to foresee the cost of ignoring my reality. I was a dysphoric amputee, cut off degree by degree, from any degree of humanity. Certainty. God, the humanity. I tried to memorize this. As a kid, what I did to keep my secret hidden was I buried my id. I screwed down the lid. I deposited her so far beneath the grid that she was forbid to do any good. And so my personality slid away, stayed away, and amid all the gray, I prayed each day for her simply to go away. But her ember burned, and she yearned to be heard, refused to be ignored, and my reality blurred, and though interred in her sepulcher, she stirred. The result? My life became a theater of the absurd. A married man, a father of two, hiding a secret nobody knew, until I told my wife, the love of my life. My revelation struck like a knife and hit her out of the blue. I didn't come out of the closet, I dragged her in, begged her not to leave. To be complicit, to practice collusion, to help me deceive through exclusion and seclusion. But this was a burden and resulted in confusion. She came to the conclusion our marriage was just an illusion. The problem with living a lie, a version of who it is you're submerging, is that this creates personality aversion. And the requisite coercion creates a climate of aversion. Aversion begets perversion of who you are as a person. The result? You become a psychological orphan, a Martian, alien life form, swallowing truth and projecting deceit through painful distortion and contortion. You're displaced, erased, identity abortion. My condition worsened. I became someone I hated, existentialist angst exacerbated by this cosmic joke to which I'd been fated. So I silently waited. My life stopped. I was in a state of stasis, alone, no help in sight, no oasis. Deflated, plagued by mental masturbation, I berated myself. I vacated myself. I negated myself. I sated myself with a secret self that destroyed mental health. Online tryst that consisted of lustful predators, all too willing to assist in validating my existence, in violating my innocence. But I knew it was wrong, that I had to desist. Yet I couldn't. In the midst of this mess, I was powerless to resist. I clenched my fist. I gritted my teeth. I was so pissed. My life, one big ball of shit, a cancerous cyst. Jesus Christ, I wanted to slit open my wrists. I went numb and succumbed to their licentious thrusts. I was groped. I was kissed. And like any woman with no self-esteem, I was summarily dismissed. Divorce imminent, facing abandonment, feeling my life was one abhorrent experiment, I was emotionally spent, and the hole that had rent my soul in two convinced me I was through. It was time to do what I knew fate had led me to end my life, to put an end to my pain and my strife, to still the voices that plagued me day and night, to go toward the light, to unplug, to drift, to submit to the white noise. I gave up, made the choice, shotgun in hand, I no longer gave a damn. Percocet, my backup plan, in case cowardice prevented me from taking aim. But photos of my daughters, memory of their laughter, the thought of leaving them to clean up after my disaster made my weakness seem malicious, sinister. My decision would freeze their growth like winter, infect their tongues with blisters, drown their voices in a crimson canyon of abandonment. My death would become their burden, innocent children left behind to harden beneath the rumors and whispers. So I got up. I got help. I moved on. Truth does come with a price, and many from my former life have withdrawn. Disowned by my father, his love conditional is now gone. Friendships too have flown, but I press on. Each day begins with a new dawn, and I am not alone. I am a roller derby queen and Wonder Woman rolled all into one. My daughter's love is a healing balm, and I'm more than a feminine father, but not quite their mom. I've been reborn, and I have reclaimed the years of shame, and now take ownership of this name. It flows through my veins and demands I take a stand. So with pen in hand, I rebrand. Do you understand? My lament is through. Instead, I give to you a declaration, this proclamation, a dedication to the prefix trans. I transmogrify gender. I transform minds. Transfixed by this splendor, I transfuse mankind. This poem is my transcript, my transsexual manifesto, my translucent primal scream. It is my transmission. It is my oath. I am a transfigure of multiplicity. I transpose body parts. I'm a transparent, oh so witty. I'm a pretty father, a trans sister, a transitional paradox. I hope you've been transported by this trans message that I spit. My perceptions, my transcription supported by my transgendered heart and wit. In the end, we are all transient, transitory. Our lives transect. True, we sometimes transgress, but many of the transactions that transpire can transport us to the ultimate truth. What we share transcends any labels we make each other wear. So I leave you with this challenge. Embrace change. Dare to seek out the strange. Rearrange your perspective to accept the biggest irony. That our individuality, the differences we insist on seeing, are in actuality what make us human beings. It's a vibrant connectivity, and I will say one last time breathlessly, my opus, while ostensibly about me, is essentially a shout-out to our shared humanity. Thank you. Okay. I was talking to Nina on the way down, and I spent about almost 3 weeks working on that. The first thing I did is I cheated. I went online and I typed in all the words that begin with trans, and I got a nice big long list. But then I had a lot of fun doing it, and you're supposed to lead with a bang or a hook or something in literature, so I wanted to start with a poem. But that's kind of, that would be like a prologue to what I'm going to be talking about today, and I'll kind of get more into it as I go along. I don't know. I'm assuming we're at the just down the hall is the GLBT Resource Center, so I'm assuming many of you probably have a basic understanding of transsexuality, but I wasn't sure one way or the other, so I just have a few slides about transsexuality in general, and then I'll transition into talking about my story. Is that okay? Does that sound like a good plan? Good, because that's what I have. So so here's a primer. Sex is what is between the legs. Gender is what is between the ears. That's kind of a good way of thinking about it. So your sex is whether you're male, you're female, you're intersexed, and it has to do with your chromosomes, your genitalia, the hormones your body produces, that's sex. Gender is man, woman, boy, girl, androgynous, gender neutral, and has to do with your internal sense of yourself and how you choose to express that to the larger world. So every individual, all of you in here, me, everyone around the world, we have a biological sex, we have a gender identity, and we have a sexual orientation. And for the majority of people out there, those three things, they just kind of fall into place, I guess. If you're born male, you see yourself as a boy or a man, and you're attracted to women, and you don't really have to think about it. It's kind of like breathing. Likewise, if you're born a girl, you grow up to be a woman, and you see yourself as a woman and are attracted to men. But that's only part of the wonderful fabric of humanity. So again, biological sex, the XY determinants and all that, gender identity, who we believe ourselves to be, and then of course your sexual orientation heterosexual, bisexual, homosexual, pansexual, or omnisexual, asexual. So being transgendered, like myself, does not mean that you're gay, necessarily. And if you are gay, it doesn't mean that you're transgendered. I happen to be attracted to women, so I guess I am transgendered, and I would be considered lesbian as well. But a lot of people, ignorant people who don't know me and don't think about it, probably see me and think, it's just a fag, or that's just a gay guy or something. So just to cover that really quick. And then I don't know why I put it down at the bottom. It seems like it should maybe go at the top. But when you have met one trans person, you've met one trans person. So we're unique and individual, just like everybody else. It's not a cookie cutter thing. Of course, like my poem said, though, the irony is that we can say that about everybody. We are unique. So the traditional binary for the gender model, again, biological sex, male, female. Notice the arrows go straight down. Gender expression, you're masculine, you're feminine, and you're attracted to the opposite sex. But I'm going to blow your mind. Here's the revolutionary gender model. This is a biological sex. Notice we have a continuum. We have male, we have intersex, we have female, and their arrows continue to go out. They don't stop at those points. So there's room for people like me, trans people. And notice that the arrows, sure, you might be male, you might be masculine, you might be attracted to women, but maybe you're male and you are androgynous or very feminine and you're attracted to both or neither or some other thing. So that's kind of where I would like to see the world go, not just tolerating diversity, but embracing diversity. And I think the world's a big enough place to do that. And I think we learn so much about each other and ourselves when we are willing to listen to the other voices in the conversation. So how did I get here today as Gina Bernard when I started as Greg Bernard? Well, I'm just going to go over some of the real quickly, the things that a trans woman such as myself have to do. The first, obviously, first and foremost is therapy, and I'll be talking about that a little later. I spent almost a decade in therapy once I finally came out. But once you're ready to begin the transition, the full transition process, you have what's called the real life experience or the real life test. And this is the act of fully adopting a new or evolving gender role or gender presentation in everyday life. And it's essential to transition because if you're like me, up until my late 20s, early 30s, everything about me that was screaming transsexuality, I mean, I didn't even know the word for most of my life, but it was all in my head. And there's like a fantasy. You can develop a pretty rich, vibrant fantasy of what it means to be, like, this is what I'd do if I was a girl or if I was a guy, you know, if you're talking to a trans man. But unless you actually are out there, you know, you're not prepared. So you can't just go and get a sex change. There's like steps involved. And the first is therapy. When you're ready, there's hormone therapy and then the real life experience. You need to be able to not just be able to go down to the gay 90s in the cities on a Saturday night, you know. You need to be able to pump gas. You need to be able to go to the grocery store. You need to be able to go to church or your work, wherever. So that's the real life test. And then the therapists and the psychiatrists that you're working with, they have a responsibility to discuss the predictable consequences of that with their patients. And it's unique and difficult and wonderful for everybody, so my case is, you know, no more special than anybody else's. But I will say that coming from a small northern upper Midwest town like Bemidji does present some specific challenges that maybe transitioning in a large metropolitan area would not, and I'll get to some of those in a little bit. Hormone replacement therapy, HRT, I pretty much stuck to how it applies to me. There are drugs, testosterone and whatnot, for females to males, and those are equally, if not in some ways, more powerful. But for the male to female patients, we are treated with estrogens and anti-androgens. The estrogen supplies what your body doesn't, and the anti-androgens kind of keep the testosterone at bay until you get an orchiectomy or the sex change. But what you can expect through having taken those for a course of time would be breast growth, redistribution of body fat to approximate a female body, decreased upper body strength, softening of the skin. My daughter, my youngest daughter, loves, we'll watch movies, and she still loves to rub my arm. Your skin's so smooth. A decrease in body hair, slowing or stopping of scalp hair loss, decreased fertility and testicular size prior to surgery, any surgery you might have, and of course less frequent and less firm erections, which as a trans woman is really a good thing. Nothing ruins the fantasy of who you are than a boner. So most of these changes are reversible, although breast development will not completely reverse after discontinuation of treatment. So if you're on it for like 2 or 3 years and then go off, you're going to be left with the breasts. Male to female surgeries include genital surgery, orchiectomy, removal of the testicles, penectomy, removal of the penis. What I had, vaginoplasty and clitoroplasty, labiaplasty. Sexual sensation is important objective, along with the creation of a functional vagina and an acceptable cosmesis. So if you're with somebody, they shouldn't be able to go, this looks weird. Other surgeries for male to female patients include, and don't have to have any of these, by the way, but they include feminization, facial surgery, breast augmentation, tracheal shaves and nose jobs and facelifts and eyelid surgery and all of that. As you can tell, I've had quite a bit of surgery. There are two photos of me. The first one was, I think, my second year at Bemidji High School. The dude in the red shirt there is probably about 1999. And then that picture to the your right? That would be me about a month before I went down for facial surgery. And I had facial surgery in the summer of 2007. As you can see, I was pretty miserable by that time. And then there's my school picture from this year down below there. So today's climate, obviously I'm honored to be here, and for you to have me here shows that the climate is improving and that you're sitting here. I really appreciate that. And all those people I was talking to somewhat angrily in my poem, it wasn't you. Okay. But there still is a long way to go. The GLBT community, and especially in some ways the trans community, still deals with workplace discrimination. Hate violence is just a chilling statistic. At least 15 transgender people are killed each year in hate-based attacks, and the FBI has estimated that there's approximately 14,000 homicides in the country each year. So based on that statistic, one in every 1,000 homicides in this country is anti-transgender hate-based crime. I feel very fortunate where I'm working to have the support of my school district, but that's not always the case. And not only at work, but in accessing healthcare and things like that. Minnesota tends to be a little bit better than some states, but we need to be moving forward, I think, as a country, as a whole. Okay, so my story, the early years. And what I've tried to do here is I went online, I tried to find a quote that I thought kind of spoke to what I'm going to talk about, and I just picked stories that I remember or things that I have been told to me that I remember about myself. So the first one is a Nietzsche quote, "You must have chaos within you to give birth to a dancing star." And this is a baby picture of mine. I was born May 18th, 1969. My father was involved in a tryst. He was serving in the Army at the time, and I think he was at Fort Ripley. And he was with a 16, 17-year-old girl, and my mom was 8 months pregnant. And my dad got into a car accident with that girl, and his injuries were so severe that they took him to the Great Lakes Naval Hospital in Chicago, Illinois. My mom went down there, and of course the trauma of seeing her husband in the intensive care unit caused her to go into labor, And so I was born at the Naval Hospital outside of Chicago, Illinois. And I don't remember anything. I don't know if I was like a trans baby or anything. I don't remember what I played with or any of that. But my mom tearfully told me the story when I came out to her. My mom wanted a daughter, and she had my older brother, and then she tried with me, and she had me, and then she tried one last time, and she got my little brother. So she got three boys out of the deal. That's what you get for trying. But apparently when I was born, her mom came to Chicago with her, and my dad was in ICU, so someone needed to be there with my mom. And I guess my grandma, who is no longer with us, but she leaned down and kissed my mom after I was born and said, "Greg was supposed to be your little girl." And my mom tells me that story. So I don't know, maybe my grandma was always very astute and kind of, she was a hipster long before hipsters. So I think maybe she saw something in me. I don't know. Please disregard the lower left picture. I almost did, and then I was like, what the heck, go for it. Wow. Actually, I'm not sure what's worse, those glasses or the fact that I let my mom cut my hair in both those pictures. I mean, that's just horrible. So this is a quote by Ralph Waldo Emerson, great transcendentalist thinker and writer. Fear defeats more people than any other one thing in the world. My first memory of being different, I was probably somewhere about that upper right picture there, maybe fourth, fifth grade. And I'm sure I was thinking things prior to that. That's just the first one as a 42-year-old trans woman. That's the first one I can remember. But my mom used to get the JCPenney catalog. And what I would do is I would wait till she was kind of done with it. And then I remember taking a pair of scissors, and I'd go through the JCPenney catalog, and I'd cut out all the pictures of the pretty women in there. And I would take glue, and I would paste them onto the pages of a notebook. And then I had a can with a lid, and, you know, as a young kid, I knew instinctively, I think, that there was something wrong with this, or I felt like there was something wrong with it. So I'd put that, my catalog, whatever you'd call it, I'd put it in that can, and then I'd go hide it in the woods. And then after school, I'd go out into the woods where I was all alone. My brother was famous for building tree forts. We had probably 20 tree forts on our property. Surprised it didn't kill all of us. And I'd go out there, and I'd go into the tree fort or in the woods, and I'd just go through that, and I remember doing that. And I don't recall what made me think it would be okay to bring it to school, but I remember bringing it to school. And it fell out of my desk. Some of you might remember the desks with the top that, you know. So I was never a very clean kid, so my desk, the inside of my desk, looked like an atom bomb had went off. There's always just piles of stuff. Well, I opened it up, and I had it in there, and it slid, like there was a little space. And I still remember it sliding and hitting the floor, and the pages came open, and some of the pictures that I glued came out and went on the floor, and all the kids started laughing at me. And that's, I distinctly remember that's when I said to myself, no, this is not right, you can't be like this. And from that point, so fourth grade, how old are you in fourth grade? Like 10, something like that? From 10 until I was in college, I never uttered a word. I never said a word to anybody. I never said it out loud to anybody. Fear set in at a very young age. Buddha, holding on to anger is like grasping a hot coal with the intent of throwing it at someone else. You are the one that gets burned. The cost of keeping this to myself, I didn't have a childhood. My folks divorced right about that time in fourth grade, and I just remember my whole life went into a tailspin for pretty much all of the rest of grade school and middle school. Trying to decide whether I wanted to live with my mother out in Wyoming or back with my friends and my dad in a dysfunctional household in Brainerd. And then you're dealing with this gender identity stuff. And by the way, this is long before the internet. I didn't know gender dysphoria. I had no idea what gender identity disorder meant. I didn't know what transsexuality, this is the 1970s in Brainerd, Minnesota. I didn't even know what gay meant. I mean, I just knew that I wanted to be a girl and that I had a penis and I wasn't a girl. So I would just constantly tell myself, knock it off, just stop it. But it was like a tape that was on loop in my head and it would never stop. And the cost of not dealing with it or not having an avenue to deal with it is I became pretty angry. I was very angry. Moved out west with my mom, and in the spring of 1981, I pointed a loaded shotgun at her and ended up in therapy for that and was almost sent to a boys' home out there, which would have been really horrible to someone who felt themselves to be a girl. But I never, even in going to therapy, I never brought it up to the therapist. I never said it. I ended up moving back to Minnesota with my father. My father is kind of big-time fisher, hunterman, that sort of northern Minnesota type guy, so I knew, sure as hell, I wasn't ever going to admit it to him. So I ended up, I moved back out to Wyoming, and I lived out there with my mom through high school eventually, and then I came back and I enrolled at Bemidji State University. And so 10 was the time I put that notebook full of pictures away and I hadn't said it. I got drunk one night, maybe my sophomore year in college, and I was all by myself, and I made my way down to Chet Anderson Stadium, which is the stadium, the football stadium there on the BSU campus. And I climbed the fence, and it was after the football season. I think it was late November, early December. And I remember I was drunk. I remember going into the stands, and I was drinking beer, and for the first time since that time at 10, I started screaming. There was a storm, it was snowing, no one was around, so I think I felt pretty safe, plus I was drunk. And I started screaming at God, and I was like, why? Imagine that. I want you to imagine that for a minute. From the time of my earliest memories, 8, 9, 10, and here I am now, I'm 18, 19, 20, the same, imagine if you had a tape in your head that was just playing this constant loop and it would never stop from the moment you got up to the moment you went to bed, and then you're plagued by nightmares and things. I mean, it just would not end. And I had no outlet. I literally had no outlet. And I remember screaming at God. I ended up that night at one of the campus chapels and the door was open and I went in there and one of the student, I don't know if it was a minister or one of the student, you know, helpers or whatever, but they saw me in there and they came over and I remember running out and going back to my dorm room and that was it. So, boom, bury it back down, right? Still had nothing to do with this. Then I ran into my ex-wife and I remember it was so wrong and yet it felt so right at the time. I remember running into my, I swam for the Bemidji State University swim team back when they had a swim team, and a couple of my teammates introduced me to her. And I remember thinking, my first thought was, if I could have been born a woman, this is who I would have wanted to be. And that, from that moment on, I was like, I'm going to marry her. Which, it seems kind of romantic, but then it also kind of seems sick, you know. That's how I idolized her. She was beautiful, but she was really down to earth. She was quiet. She just had all those qualities of peace and serenity that I, you know, I was in turmoil. Well, fortunately for me, she thought I was pretty cool too. And of course, I never said anything to her about my gender stuff, but a lie cannot live, Martin Luther King Jr. And my entire relationship with her was based on a lie. And we had two daughters. Those are my daughters, Madison in the black dress and Parker in the purple dress there. That's Parker in the gray and Maddie in the blue laying there. They're 14 and 11 now, but those are cute pictures before they turned into the girls that give me gray hair now. Oh,
Warning.
The next slide is going to show you a couple of pictures from my feminine facial surgery. Courage is resistance to fear, mastery of fear, not absence of fear. Mark Twain wrote that. I went down and had facial surgery with Mark Zukowski in Chicago, Illinois. My ex-wife, to her great commendations, we weren't yet divorced, but she went with me and was my nursemaid. I remember nothing of that week. People always ask me, oh man, you had the genital surgery, didn't that hurt? I'm like, yeah, but, and then I show them pictures of this and they understand. I was just either combination of drugs or just the pain or whatever, but there's about 7 days that I just have no recollection. I have like passing little snippets of memories. But I show you this not for shock value, but I show you just how powerful that tape playing in your head is. I always felt like I was blind. I'd look in the mirror every day and I'd be like, that's not who you're supposed to look like. I have no idea who you are, buddy, in the mirror. That's not the voice I hear inside my head that I feel in my heart. And it drives people to do some pretty drastic things. This is an elective surgery. This is not covered by insurance. I had to pay for this all myself. It was almost a 10-hour surgery. I had a nose job. I had cheek implants. I had my hairline lowered. I had a facelift. I had my jaw shaved. I had my upper lip shortened. I had a tracheal shave. I don't remember any of it. That, by the way, down there, that's a picture of me approximately 8 days after surgery. So the human body is remarkable at recovering. By the way, if you're wondering, are we going to get to see a picture of her genitals? No. Unless you really want to, I brought photo albums. So my story transitions. Achievement brings its own anti-climax. You know, for all those years I was thinking, God, I can't do this. And I had a long list of can'ts, you know. I'm too tall. My voice is too deep. I'm a teacher. Outside of the military, what possible career could you have where they're not going to accept you? Teaching. Parents would, you know, I literally envision people hanging me from a tree in the woods behind Bemidji somewhere. And I laugh at it now, but, you know, for a long time, that's the kind of, that was the other tape playing in my head. I had a list of why I couldn't transition. The actual day I transitioned was the day Barack Obama took presidency, January 20th, 2009. And I transitioned over a 3-day weekend between fall semester and winter semester. I had been outed 2 years before, so everybody knew. They were just kind of waiting for me to, you know, shit or get off the pot. So I went home on a Friday as Mr. Bernard. I entered my grades. We had a long 3-day weekend. I came back Monday morning as Miss Bernard, and I remember getting up that. I didn't sleep much, as you can imagine, but I remember getting up. I showered. I got all ready. I got into my women's clothes. I took a deep breath, and I went into work, and I looked at my watch, and it was like 3:05. The day was over. And I went home, and I was just shaking. The alarm went off on Tuesday. I got up. By Wednesday, it was like, why the hell did it take me 38 years to do this? Fear. Fear is the biggest hurdle. And once you get over that fear, it doesn't mean your life isn't going to be without pain, without turmoil, but it does mean you can attack lots of problems that you don't think you can. So here are just a few pictures. The one in the hat there is what I look like pretty much. I think that was over Christmas break before I transitioned at the end of January, so that's pretty much how I looked. And then those two pictures are from this year. Jim Morrison, Doors fan. Expose yourself to your deepest fear. After that, fear has no power, and the fear of freedom shrinks and vanishes. You are free. This is a fortune cookie I got. I started therapy in about 2000, and shortly after I started therapy, went to a Chinese restaurant up in Bemidji, and we always get the fortune cookies. And by the way, if you get a fortune cookie, you can't open your own fortune cookie. Like, if there's four people at the table, you have to give it to somebody else. Just keep that in mind. My daughter, one of my daughters, gave me the fortune cookie that had that fortune in it. You will be compelled to manifest self-transformation. Wow. And she was tiny. I mean, she was like 3 and a half when she did that. So I don't know. It just, and I put tape around it and I kept it in my wallet until I got a purse. And now it's in this book right here with all the other fortune cookies I've collected throughout the years that seem to speak to me. Some of you may know Dr. This is Trinidad, Colorado. And that's Marcy Bowers and me at our pre-surgery consult the day before. And then in Trinidad, Trinidad's known for these bricks that have the town name on them. So when you go there for surgery, every surgical patient gets a brick, and you get to paint it any way you want. And so that's the, I think, 3 days after my surgery, I came home and painted the brick. Emily Dickinson, I dwell in possibility. My life since I transitioned, you hear those analogies of people who never used to wear glasses, and then they wear glasses, and all of a sudden it isn't just like a green blob. They can see the individual leaves, and they can see the bark. That's my life since then. I'm in a band with Nina down there. I started taking drumming lessons, because once you do what I did, there's nothing you can't do, or at least there's nothing you can't try. And I'd always wanted to be like a drummer chick, so I started taking drumming lessons last year. I joined the Babe City Rollers roller derby team up in Bemidji. That's just been a godsend to me, very powerful group of women. And I have a much closer and more beautiful relationship with my daughters because I'm not cranky all the time and angry. They used to say I was always so angry. So I'm going to leave you with a couple of quotes from Rainier Maria Rilke. Perhaps all the dragons of our lives are princesses who are only waiting to see us once beautiful and brave. And these are my princesses, Maddie and Elizabeth. And I've been talking quite a bit about my story, but before we open up into questions here, I would like you to think about your own lives. So I'm going to leave you with a challenge, your story. And this too is a quote by Rilke. Have patience with everything unresolved in your heart and try to love the questions themselves as if they were locked rooms or books written in a very foreign language. Don't search for the answers, which could not be given to you now because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps then, someday, far in the future, you will gradually, without even noticing it, live your way into the answer. My mom gave me this when I was in the hospital after my suicide attempt. And I hung that in my room in the hospital, and that got me through quite some hard times. Okay, I was told to leave you guys with about 10 minutes for questions, so I will do that if you have any. Or I can pass around my pictures. Yes. How do my daughters identify me now?
Do they still call you Dad? Or?
They do. We went over that. Initially, they kind of came up with lists. And they're like, we could call you Gigi. And I was like, well, why would you call me Gigi? Well, your name was Greg, and now it's Gina. So we'll call you Gigi. Well, their great-grandma, that's what they called her, Gigi. And I was like, no, that's your great-grandma's. And then they're like, we could call you Auntie. And I'm like, well, if you're going to call me anything like that, you might as well call me what. So they finally said, I think, and my oldest daughter expressed me, they were afraid that they were going to, like, they wanted to call me Dad, but they were afraid that with the transition, I wouldn't want them to. They're very protective of me. So when I finally said, I am your dad, and I'm not denying that. I'm so super proud of both of you. I want to be your dad, so let's just go with Dad. So it's really cute. Nina can attest to this. They call me Daddy, Dad, and then they'll use she and her in the same sense. They never get the pronoun wrong. They always get it. But it has caused some interesting things. You know, like you can imagine if I'm in the Target bathroom with my youngest daughter, and she's in one stall and I'm in the other one, and she's like, Dad, is there any toilet paper over there? No! But she is my biggest supporter. If people stare at me, she'll be like right in their face, like, well, how do you like it? And, you know? So, Yeah, that's kind of how they've dealt with it. One of the reasons I wanted to transition so soon, I have a lot of friends that wait. They think there's a perfect time to do it. I'll wait till my kids grow up and then I'll transition. The problem with waiting until your kids grow up is kids are malleable. Kids adapt to change. Kids love just unconditionally. And fear sets in. And most of my friends who've waited until they're in their 50s or 60s, they've really struggled with their children because they're, you know, by the time you're 24, 25, you have one image of who your dad is, and then boom, all of a sudden. Whereas my girls were still quite young. You know, they were, oh, I came out to them in 2007, so my youngest daughter was 7 and my oldest daughter was 10. So there was some tears, there was some questions, there was some therapy sessions, but they adapted very quickly. In fact, it was my youngest daughter who outed me to the community. Because I didn't want them to be like, this is a bad secret and this is something shame-filled. So I told them when I came out to them, you guys can, if you need to tell somebody, but this is kind of a family thing, so you don't need to like at show and tell, raise your hand, but... Well, that was like on a Saturday, I think I told her. Monday morning, she told her friend on the playground. Her friend's mom happened to be a teacher at the school. Her friend told her mom at dinner that night, Facebook, Twitter, iPhones, boom. It was gone. It was out there. So, but I don't hold that against her. She kind of prodded me forward. Kids have a wonderful way of doing that sometimes. Other questions? Yes.
When in your process did you choose the name Gina? Because I have a friend who's transgender right now, and he has Jane up on my Facebook and stuff, but when I'm actually around him, he does still go by his original name.
Mm-hmm.
So when did you and Dr. actually start using it all as gender right now?
Well, the question is, when did I adopt the name Gina, and when did I first start using that? I went through a series of names. I was thinking Grace for a while, but one of my pet peeves with other trans people is they pick names that are, they either sound like stripper names or hooker names or Hello Kitty type names, and it's like, dude, you're 65-year-old, you know, over the road trucker. Your name can't be Tiffany with an I. So I kind of went through the gracing, and then I was like, well, Greg has 4 letters. Gina has 4 letters. I always thought Marie was just a beautiful, I think it's one of the most common middle names for girls that there is. So I always like Marie. My former name was Greg Richard Bernard, so I wanted an R, and I thought about Gina Renee Bernard, but I have 3 girlfriends that are Renee, and I didn't want to risk like offending any of them or making it weird. So that's how I decided on Gina. In terms of when I first started using it, it was... When I came back to school after that long weekend. So January 20th, 2009. And I didn't want the whole, you know, living as Greg, but call me Gina. And as long as I was still presenting as male, it sounds like your friend might from time to time, then I was... The problem I had is I told all my friends when I came back, you know, if saying Gina is just too weird for you, you can say G. I was like giving them an out for that first half year. I still have colleagues at school that call me G. I'm like, come on. So now what I do is I just call them by their first letter. And then they kind of look at me and they're like, oh, okay. Yes?
How did you cope with your relationship with your father?
Sure. How did I cope with my relationship with my father? Well, luckily, he took that decision out of my hands. When I first came out to my wife in 2000... I was working with a therapist in Bemidji who had no experience with trans people. So she sent me down to the University of Minnesota. Saved my life, literally saved my life. But I would go 4 hours for a 1-hour appointment, drive 4 hours back. I mean, you really have to know this is something you want to put up with that. But one of the things that we pretty quickly decided with my therapist is you need to come out to who you feel comfortable with and who's going to need to know, like your family. So I told my dad, I think sometime in 2001. He was pretty cordial on the phone, but then he thought about it, and he wrote me a letter. And his letter said, you will never be more than a man in a dress. You will always be my son. If you do this, I will have nothing to do with you. Words to those effect. And then, you know, I was in the fear thing, so after I told my wife, I had about 8 more years of marriage before it finally all unraveled, and, you know, birthing processes are hard, and it took me that long to kind of be reborn. But during that intervening years, on my birthday, he would send me, "Dear son, you are the best son a father," and he'd like underline all of the male words in it. And so when I ended up in the hospital and then came out of there and transitioned, I have not spoke to him since 2008. That's how I've dealt with it. Internally, how do I deal with it? It sucks. He lives in Grand Rapids, and that's where my ex-wife moved with my daughters. He lives within a crow's mile, you know, as a crow's fly, a mile from my kids. And his guilt at how he's treating me, he will not have anything to do with them. He can't, because he knows they love me and I have a relationship with them, so how could he possibly hang out with them or do anything? He sends them money on Christmas and birthday, but he lives a mile from them. I live 65 miles down the road. I'm lucky if I get them 2 weekends a month during the school year. And it's just asinine, but, you know, at the end of the day, it's, my mom told me this when I was in the hospital too. She said, "What other people think of you is none of your business." And that's a hard thing to get over, because you want people to like you. You want it, and we do. We want to be accepted. We're social creatures. But I had to get over that. I had to make that a you problem, not a me problem. And my heart's still open. If he ever wants to sit down and reopen those channels, he's more than welcome to. But I'm not holding my breath. Sure. I have absolutely nothing better to do today than to talk about myself.
And I would like to thank you for being such an amazing mentor and role model and a courageous person.
Thank you very much. And thank you for having me. Thank you. Oh, yeah, I brought copies of my poem. Maybe, Nina, if you just want to put them on the table up there, if anybody wants a copy.